Let's begin the reading of today's Boston Herald on this Thursday, the 19th of February, 2026. With today's Boston Herald, we say hello to Doug.
Welcome, listeners. Front page of the Boston Herald today. Terror on the tracks. T-Rider kicked into train. City needs to crack down on marauding teens. And Olympic thriller. U.S. men's hockey edges Sweden in OT. And jailed ex-State Union boss gets 2 years. Let's start there. With an article by Grace Zuckovich. Ex-State Union boss gets 2 years. Sentenced with lobbyists in racketeering fraud scheme. The former State Police Association of Massachusetts president and state lobbyists have been sentenced in federal court for a years-long organized criminal enterprise to defraud union members in the state and gain thousands in bribes and kickbacks, law enforcement officials announced on Wednesday. Dana Pullman and Ann Lynch ran the Massachusetts State Police Union like an old-school racket, siphoning money from troopers, deceiving the Commonwealth, hiding income from the IRS, and then lying when they got caught, said U.S. Attorney Leah Foley. Their conduct was deliberate, sustained, and corrosive. The men and women of the Massachusetts State Police deserve leaders who protect their interests, not exploit them. Dana Pullman, 64, of Worcester, and Ann Lynch, 75, of Hull, were each sentenced in U.S. District Court on Wednesday after being convicted on charges including racketeering, fraud, obstruction of justice, and tax crimes in 2022. The pair were originally sentenced in May 2023 before having some convictions, including wire fraud and obstruction of justice, reversed in 2025, and their cases remanded for resentencing. Pullman will serve 2 years in prison to be followed by 1 year of supervised release and pay $43,915 in restitution, Judge Richard Stearns ordered Wednesday. Lynch will serve 15 months in prison to be followed by 1 year of supervised release and pay $41,795 in restitution. Boston IRS Criminal Investigation Special Agent Thomas DeMio called the case a serious breach of public trust, with the two exploiting their positions and betraying the very people they were meant to serve. Pullman was president of the over 15,000 member state police union from 2012 until his resignation in 2018, during which time Lynch worked as a lobbyist representing the union in exchange for monthly retainer payments. During the 6 years, prosecutors said, the pair used their position to capitalize on a racketeering enterprise defrauding the state, IRS, and union members. Among the criminal conduct, the U.S. Attorney's Office said were instances like a $20,000 kickback to Pullman in connection with a state settlement agreement. Pullman also stole from the union on his own, the office said, using his position debit card to pay for items like a vacation in Miami and lunch of champagne and caviar in New York with his then-girlfriend. Former Massachusetts State Police trooper and union boss Dana Pullman should know better than anyone, crime doesn't pay, said Boston FBI Special Agent in Charge Ted Docks. Yet he joined forces with lobbyist Ann Lynch to run the State Police Association of Massachusetts like an organized criminal enterprise to rake in thousands of dollars in bribes, kickbacks for their own financial gains at the cost of their integrity, careers, and freedom. An article by Colleen Cronin, three-alarm blaze rips through home. A three-alarm fire in Jamaica Plain sent a firefighter and a resident to the hospital early Wednesday morning. Boston Fire responded to the heavy fire at 98 Wyman Street at around 4:45 a.m., which had spread to the home next door, the department said. A second and third alarm were quickly ordered. Firefighters were able to get everyone out of the building with one resident transported by Boston EMS, according to Deputy Chief Gerard Viola. The firefighter was also taken to the hospital after the ceiling of one of the buildings collapsed. The Red Cross is helping the 11 adults, 2 children, cat and dog displaced by the fire after finding housing. Detailed companies will remain on scene to monitor hotspots, the department said. Boston Fire is investigating the cause of the blaze. Joe Battenfeld's column today. Teens terrorize tea riders in Wootopia. Could be a long summer as city groups of marauding teens on foot and motorized bikes terrorize tea riders and residents, while an MIA, Mayor Michelle Wu, and police stand by. The latest violent incident came Tuesday evening when 27-year-old man was kicked onto a departing Orange Line train by a group of teens robbing and harassing riders on the Back Bay platform. He was hurt with a head wound, but it could easily have been worse. T officials initially said nothing about the incident, but later admitted Wednesday the bloodied victim came in contact with the train. At one point, the victim was kicked. The force of the kick propelled the victim backwards as an MBTA train was departing, Transit Police Superintendent Richard Sullivan said. It's my understanding the victim did contact the train. Your understanding? Really? Where were the police? Why are police now trying to diminish the threat of riders? Isn't it important that we don't keep T-riders in the dark? Where is GM Philip Train Daddy Eng, who made $500,000 a year? I caution you, in taking preliminary initial statements from officers on scene via radio transmissions as factual. Misinformation and miscommunication on active scenes unfortunately happens, Sullivan, who earned $239,203 in 2025, said in the press release. This is why we must have a meaningful opportunity to investigate. This is the second time in the last few months that a T-rider has been assaulted. In the early incident, a homeless man pushed a woman onto the tracks. The question now is the T really safe to ride? And in Wootopia, is it safe to walk in downtown crossing in the seaport? And what is Mayor's strategy to combat these incidents as the warmer weather draws near and more kids are out on the streets and out of school? No one was arrested in the Back Bay incident, of course, but for shocked witnesses, it was an alarming and frightening commute home. Police said they are actively investigating and reviewing video footage. This crime came a few days after a group of young people riding e-bikes and dirt bikes infiltrated Chinatown and Boston Common, frightening residents and prompting a city councilor to question whether police are enforcing the laws. Neighbors and pedestrians throughout the city of Boston, including our seniors, persons with disabilities, and young families, consistently bring up the lack of enforcement on all two-wheeled vehicle operating on sidewalks, running red lights and stop signs, and going the wrong way down the street, Flynn wrote in an ordinance he is submitting to the council. Flynn, who is consistently ignored by Wu and her stooges on the council, will no doubt find his ordinance filed in some obscure committee and left to die. But he has been one of the few moderate voices of reason in the city. We have traffic laws on the books for a reason, he said, to provide a safe environment for all. We must enforce traffic laws in Boston and acknowledge and address the senseless and random violence we are witnessing across our neighborhoods. We must have zero tolerance for any criminal activity in Boston. Those involved in criminal activity need to be held responsible in our court system. Wu has been in Germany all week on a paid junket which coincidentally is on security and has no public appearances in Boston for days. In Munich, her second trip out of the country since winning re-election, Wu was posing for photographs with Hillary Clinton and shining up her national profile, which is prompting speculation about her political future. Even when she comes back, she will do nothing to crack down on these violent teens breaking the law and making the city unsafe to live and work in. That's because she has long claimed Boston is the safest major city in the country, a laughable assertion given the latest incidents. In a companion piece to that by Colleen Cronin, MBTA, man kicked into moving train. A 27-year-old man was injured after allegedly being kicked into a train by a group of teens at the MBTA Back Bay station on Tuesday. The group of juveniles and the man got into a verbal altercation at around 6:46 p.m., according to MBTA Police Superintendent Richard Sullivan. The dispute turned physical near and on the platform area, Sullivan wrote in an email to the Herald. The juveniles allegedly tried to strike and kick the victim. At one point, the victim was kicked and the force of the kick propelled the victim backwards as an MBTA train was departing, Sullivan wrote. It is my understanding that the victim did contact the train. The group fled the scene and EMS was requested. According to Sullivan, the victim sustained an injury to his forehead, but he was conscious and alert at the scene. MBTA police are investigating the incident. Article by Aaron Curtis. Lawyers seek to blow open alleged cover-up. Hearing sought in fatal cruiser crash. Motion cites troopers' alleged BAC. Delayed inquiry. Defense attorneys in the Fahn murder retrial are seeking an evidentiary hearing into what is described as a state police cover-up surrounding a fatal 2023 crash in which Sergeant Scott Quigley, a key investigator in the case, was allegedly intoxicated and driving nearly twice the speed limit. The filing submitted in Middlesex Superior Court on Friday asked to subpoena 19 current and former law enforcement officials, including Quigley, to testify under oath about how the Woburn crash was handled and when key information was disclosed. According to the motion filed by attorney Mark Wester for Billy Fahn, Lorenzo Perez from Biloam Fahn, and William Dolan for Chana Fahn, discovered materials show that at about 5 p.m. December 12, 2023, Quigley was traveling 59 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone in an unmarked cruiser on Lexington Street when he crossed into oncoming traffic and struck a handicapped accessible van carrying 37-year-old Angelo Cicchino, a disabled paraplegic who died a month later from his injuries. Quigley has not been charged in the case. A report from the Disabled Persons Protection Commission states Cicchino was riding in a wheelchair inside the van operated by the nonprofit Bridgewell, Inc., and was returning from a medical appointment when the head-on crash occurred. Quigley was taken to Lahey Hospital in Burlington with serious injuries. Medical records turned over in discovery documented Quigley's blood alcohol concentration at 0.114. The motion further notes that upon arrival, Quigley, a former Woburn police officer, told hospital staff he was suffering from lack of sleep and had been at the scene of an infant death earlier that day. Despite the severity of the crash, the defense argues state police investigators waited 8 days to interview Quigley, never sought his toxicology results, and issued only a marked lane citation. Records show the state police and Quigley's toxicology results by March 2024, but the information was not disclosed in the Fahn case until jury selection in January, a delay that prompted Judge Chris Barry Smith to ask during a February hearing Who knew what when? The 19 witnesses who the defense seeks to call include Woburn police officers who first responded to the crash, state police supervisors and prosecutors, including former Middlesex Assistant District Attorney Daniel Harron, who was the lead prosecutor during the first Fahn trial, and current ADA Thomas Brandt, who is part of the current prosecution team. A key witness on the list is State Police Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, the crash investigator, who the motion states did not interview Quigley until 8 days after the collision and did not obtain his toxicology results. The filing states that Penton must establish whether she examined evidence from Quigley's cruiser that would determine his speed, reportedly 59 miles per hour in a 30 mile per hour zone, according to vehicle records. Why she failed to seek his toxicology results from Leahy Hospital, why she issued only a warning citation for a marked lane violation despite serious injuries to all three people involved in the crash, why she waited to speak with Quigley, and why she did not interview the Woburn officers Quigley claimed to have interacted with at the scene. The motion also cites a report Penton wrote in support of Quigley's state police notice of injury claim, in which she wrote that Quigley told her he had responded to an infant death call earlier that day and had been unable to sleep and had fielded multiple follow-up calls, including that he was injured through no fault of his own and in the performance of his duties. In a footnote, the motion makes note that Penton was indicted on February 6 by a Worcester grand jury on charges of involuntary manslaughter, causing serious bodily injury to a participant in a physical training program, and perjury in connection with the 2024 death of state police recruit Enrique Delgado Garcia at the State Police Training Academy in New Braintree. Penton has since been relieved of duty and had her certification suspended. Quigley was suspended without pay earlier this month, and his case has been referred to the Suffolk District Attorney's Office for possible criminal charges. Defense attorneys argued that the handling of Quigley's crash and the timing of the disclosures raises questions about whether the Middlesex District Attorney's Office met its obligation to turn over information bearing on his credibility. Was the unit, many of whom are witnesses in our case, responsible for investigating homicides in the state of Massachusetts, complicit, actively covering up the involuntary homicide committed by one of its own, who was also a key witness in this case? Perez said following the February 9th hearing. Schettino's family has filed a civil lawsuit against the state police alleging negligence in connection with the crash. As a result of that lawsuit, many of the documents detailing the accident and actions of Quigley and the state police have come to light. Turn to an article by Gayla Cowley. Status quo is not acceptable. New approach pitched to tackle mass and cast drug market. Boston community leaders propose a new plan to tackle the open-air drug market at and around Mass and Cass that focuses on getting addicts off the streets, out of jail, and into recovery in order to avoid last summer's crowding and chaos. The three-pronged choice-based approach is built around recovery, judicial and public safety initiatives. It aims to fill in the gaps in the city's current fragmented response system that has created the perception for addicts frequenting and troubled area that their only two options are detox or jail, Boston City Councilor John Fitzgerald said Wednesday as the working group he co-chairs was announcing their new plan. The whole goal is to get people into long-term recovery and make sure they're not falling through the cracks, Sue Sullivan, executive director of the New Market Business Improvement District, and another co-chair told the Herald. From my perspective, I would say that it's inhumane if we allow people to stay on the streets and not help them. It doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't do the person themselves any good. It doesn't do the residents and businesses any good, Sullivan added. The new plan was put forward by representatives from South End, Roxbury, and Newmarket Community Working Group that focuses on mass and cast. It seeks to integrate public safety and public health intervention to clean up the open drug use, dealing, and crime that has festered for years at and around the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard. State Representative John Warren, a co-chair of the working group, said the new plan aims to blunt the uptick in public drug use seen in the neighborhoods that surround Mass and Cass each year when the weather warms up. Last summer was particularly bad, he said, citing the home break-ins and crime tied to the area's open drug market. The status quo is not acceptable, Moran said. We absolutely cannot go back to what we had last spring and summer. Two things can be true at the same time. You need public safety. You also need to have compassion for people, but we need to have that balance. Working group leaders said the plan builds on the city's shift in approach at Mass and Cass from the last September and was requested by Mayor Michelle Wu, although it's not clear yet whether the city will implement their recommendations. Wu released a non-committal statement Wednesday that said the city is prepping for the warm weather spike in drug activity and crowding at Mass and Cass, continuing to engage with all stakeholders on our coordinated approach. Alongside partners in community public health and across government, Boston is working to ensure strong pathways into recovery and quality of life in every neighborhood, including an end to outdoor substance use, Wu said. I thank the working group for carefully reflecting the shared progress of the many city departments engaged in our coordinated response team, for their strong endorsement of the Boston Police Department's NEST initiative, and for highlighting more opportunities to meet our shared goals, the mayor added. The city has referred close to 480 people to treatment since September 15th, according to Kelly Young, director of the mayor's coordinated response team and co-chair of the working group. The group's proposal would expand specialized units like NEST, the police department's neighborhood engagement safety team, which is trained to diversion and deflection, to work alongside so-called core team of people with lived experience in recovery to get people in the path to recovery, Fitzgerald said. The proposal calls for the establishment of specialty recovery court that would allow addicts to bypass traditional criminal charges and be diverted to treatment should they choose the path over incarceration. A preferred provider network and case management teams would then follow patients who choose recovery through every step of the process, including physical and mental health support, working group representatives said. Should a person relapse, the proposed model would trigger immediate re-engagement by the core team to restart the recovery pathway without unnecessary barriers, group representation said. Fitzgerald said the plan would be paid for by a combination of city, state, and federal funds, but the group has not yet estimated how much it would cost, according to Moran. By focusing on diverting people to addiction treatment and then more closely monitoring their progress after their referrals, Fitzgerald said, the city will be able to get more people off the streets and give them a better chance of staying sober by avoiding the rinse and repeat detox of incarceration path. We're creating a pathway here where it allows people to have choice throughout the process about what's best for them, Fitzgerald said. It also gives them the most opportunity to stay on the road to recovery. Oliver D'Agostino, a 37-year-old former addict, credited the interventions of the city coordinated response team, which the group plans to seek to enhance with keeping him alive by helping him stay accountable during his recovery. Before he accepted treatment, he was living like cattle outside on a city bike path, he said. I was tired of letting people down, and I realized these strangers cared more about me than I cared about myself, D'Agostino said. If they had given up on me after the first, second, or third time, I'd still be on the bike path, in jail or worse. Sullivan said she anticipated people may be skeptical about a treatment-based plan for an area widely recognized as the epicenter of the region's opioid crisis. There are those who would say that what we are doing, pushing people to try to choose recovery, doesn't work, Sullivan said. Some would say that when individuals are incentivized to go into recovery, 50% will fail, and then they will be more vulnerable when they come back on the streets. The reality is that on the streets, 0% are getting better, and many overdose daily. We cannot stand by and continue to let this happen. An article by Tim Nunn. Hell no, he won't go. Markey joins Dems boycotting Trump's State of the Union address. U.S. Senator Ed Markey says he will be boycotting President Trump's State of the Union address next week and will instead join the People's State of the Union, along with several fellow congressional Democrats, in a counter-programming demonstration against the president. The State of the Union should be a reckoning with reality, but Donald Trump will use it to spin fiction and normalize the gross abuse of power. He will claim everything is fine while families struggle to afford health care and housing. Immigrant communities live in fear, and his billionaire allies loot the country under cover of chaos. I will not legitimize those lies, Markey said in a press release. MSNBC personalities Joy Reid and Katie Fang have been tapped to host the event, which will feature a lineup including Markey and fellow Democratic U.S. Senators Jeff Merkley, Chris Murphy, Tina Smith, Chris Van Hollen, and U.S. Representatives Yasmin Ansari, Becca Balint, Greg Caesar, Pramila Jayapal, Sydney Kamlagar-Dove, John Larson, Delia Ramirez, Bonnie Watson-Coleman, and the event will also feature other soon-to-be-announced elected officials, leaders, and advocates, according to the press release. The New York Times reports that House Minority Leader Representative Hakeem Jeffries is encouraging Democrats to either boycott the speech altogether or sit through it silently rather than splitting lawmakers between both events and creating distractions in the House chamber. We're not going to his house. He's coming to our house. Having grown up where I grew up, you never let anyone run you off your block, Jeffrey said. Organizers say everyday Americans most impacted by Trump's dangerous and reckless agenda will join the hosts and lawmakers on stage. Markey went out on to tie in Massachusetts' role in the American Revolution to imply Trump views himself as a king. 250 years ago, the American Revolution began in Massachusetts because we refused to bow to a king, and Donald Trump does not believe in we the people or the Democratic Union forged here in 1776. He believes in power for himself, said Markey. If Trump will not honor the American people, then the people should turn off his remarks and turn toward each other, toward their neighbors, their communities, and the real power of this country. I am proud to join the People's State of the Union to make clear that in America, power belongs to the people, not to a corrupt and immoral president who thinks he is above the law. The event, described as counter-programming, focused on elevating the voices of Americans impacted by President Trump's reckless and dangerous agenda, is organized by Medea's Touch and Move On Civic Action. As of the timing of this article, no other member of the Massachusetts federal delegation have announced that they are joining the boycott. And here's an article by Lance Reynolds. DA fights to bring accused killer to justice. Ecuadorian national fled to native country after killing wife, toddler son in Brockton in 2011. 15 years after their brutal deaths, Plymouth DA Tim Cruz is continuing to fight to bring the Ecuadorian national back to Massachusetts to face criminal prosecution for murdering his wife and toddler-age son. Interpol has recently reissued a red notice for Luis Guaman, a now 55-year-old man who fled from JFK Airport in New York to his native country a day after the bodies of his wife and son were found in a dumpster near their Brockton residence in February 2011. An autopsy determined that the 25-year-old mother, Maria Avelina Palaguchi Sela, and 2-year-old son, Brian Chuanga Palaguchi, died as a result of blunt force trauma to the head and brain. Investigators also discovered a blood-stained sledgehammer and Guaman's fingerprints on the duffel bag that contained the two bodies in the dumpster. Cruz has been fighting for true justice in the case for the past 15 years, demanding that Guaman be extradited to the U.S. to face a murder trial here. His efforts, though, have fallen short. The Plymouth County DA has received notice from Interpol and Guaman that Guaman remains subject to a red notice and is on the international wanted list. Every 5 years, DAs must revalidate that arrest warrant so that it's still active, Cruz's office stated on Wednesday. As long as I am District Attorney of Plymouth County, Cruz said in a statement, my office will never stop demanding that Luis Guaman be brought back to our community to answer for his heinous crimes. Investigators working the gruesome case collaborated with the FBI to seek and gain a red notice for Guaman in 2011. Guaman initially entered the U.S. illegally. An Ecuadorian jury found Guaman guilty after a two-day trial in 2012, sentencing him to 25 years in prison. If convicted in Massachusetts, Guaman would face life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that's why Cruz says he remains committed to fighting for Guaman's extradition. His battle has included calling upon then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other national lawmakers to join his demands for Guaman to be returned from Ecuador. Ecuador has refused to extradite Guaman to the U.S., citing how its constitution bars the extradition of its own citizens. While I maintain respect for Ecuador's legal system, Cruz said, true justice can only be sought in this matter by having Guaman stand trial in our country and prosecuted for the brutal murders of caring mother and her child. Here's an article by Grace Zuckovich. New options for downtowns. Healy touts $140 million for housing initiatives, 1,300 new homes predicted. The state will invest over $140 million in the creation of more than 1,000 homes across the state, the Healy administration announced Wednesday, funding another round of affordable residences and transforming vacant commercial buildings through two state programs. Too many downtown buildings across Massachusetts are sitting dark and empty when they could be part of the solution to our housing shortage, said Governor Maura Healey. The Affordable Homes Act gave us new tools to move faster and smarter, and this first round of commercial conversion tax credits will help turn underused commercial properties into homes, bring new energy to our downtown and our downtowns, and lower housing costs for residents. The funding announcement marks the first round of commercial conversion tax credit initiatives awards since the program was created under a $5.2 billion housing bond Healy signed in 2024. The initiative will distribute $8.4 million to 5 projects, creating 339 homes across Boston, Fitchburg, New Bedford, Pittsfield, and Worcester. The projects are distributed among downtowns and neighborhood centers where commercial buildings are underutilized and where new housing can help bring foot traffic, customers, and energy back to local business districts, the administration stated. The Boston project will deliver 18 units on Milk Street in the financial district, while the largest project in Worcester will create 198 homes in a historic office building downtown. Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll called the awards part of a downtown comeback, noting that creating housing in these central areas support local businesses, strengthen neighborhoods, and help more people live closer to jobs, transit, and everyday amenities. Another $139.5 million will go out through the Affordable Housing Development Grant Program, delivering low-income housing tax credits and subsidies to 15 rental housing developments across the state. The developments represent 903 affordable homes and 284 home for extremely low-income households, including individuals and families transitioning from homelessness, the administration stated. These 15 developments will help move 1,008 homes forward statewide, delivering the homes seniors, families, and workers need to stay in the communities that they call home, said Executive Office of Housing and Living Communities Secretary Ed Augustus. The projects spread across Beverly, East Hampton, Framingham, Greenfield, Lawrence, Lenox, Lowell, New Bedford, Newton, Pittsfield, and Westfield, along with 4 Boston developments delivering 271 homes. Pittsfield Mayor Peter Marchetti said Wednesday that the announcement supports the city's long-term vision for housing as we continue to provide options that serve every need. As an article by the Associated Press, deep sea tech deployed to find wreck of Lily Jean. A coalition of authorities is deploying technology to try to locate the wreck of a fishing boat that sank last month off Massachusetts, killing all 7 aboard. But winter weather and sea conditions have thus far slowed their efforts. The 72-foot vessel Lily Jean was returning to port early January 30th to repair fishing gear when it sank in frigid Atlantic waters off the historic fishing port of Gloucester. Multiple agencies, including the U.S. Coast Guard, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Massachusetts Environmental Police, are cooperating to try to find the wreck of the ship and potentially recover the bodies of the deceased, officials said on Wednesday. The Lily Jean sank in waters that were more than 300 feet deep and very inhospitable in winter. Environmental police have deployed side-scanned sonar to try to gather data and detect anomalies on the ocean floor, officials said. They said they also hope to be able to send a remotely operated vehicle to the site to gather photos and videos, but seas have thus far made that challenging. Officials will provide updates to the community that is still grieving the loss of the victim, said Massachusetts Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, a Republican of Gloucester. One of the most haunting things about grief or loss at sea is the not knowing, Tarr said during a news conference on Wednesday. Answering those questions requires a tremendous amount of effort. The Coast Guard initially launched a search and rescue mission after receiving an alert from the vessel about 25 miles off Cape Ann. Searchers found a debris field near where the alert was sent, along with a body in the water and an empty life raft, the Coast Guard said. The search was suspended the following day, and the community has rallied around the families of the victims since. Ricky Beal, brother of Paul Beal Sr., said during Wednesday's news conference that he is hopeful the investigations will help families in the community better understand what happened. He also encouraged anyone following the investigation not to spread false information about it. As of now, hopefully in the future, the investigation will give us some light on what happened. But as of now, only God knows what happened that fateful morning, Beal said. An article by Tim Dunn. GOP senators seek hearing on EBT fraud. Caucus cites Herald report, Fed bust, and auditor's findings. State Senate Republicans are calling for an oversight hearing on SNAP EBT fraud in Massachusetts after the Herald reported a whistleblower claim of rampant and unabated fraud within the program, and as several other SNAP fraud schemes have been uncovered by the feds and the state auditor. The caucus sent a letter Wednesday to Senate Post Audit and Oversight Committee Chair Senator Mark Montigny, requesting a hearing on significant and recurring evidence of SNAP EBT fraud, operational failures within the Department of Transitional Assistance, and the Commonwealth's inability to adequately protect taxpayer funds and program beneficiaries. A recent whistleblower report featured in the Boston Herald and based on the comments of a DTA employee details specific instances of internal dysfunction within the DTA, amplifies the main reason for the concern with these benefits and the way they are being administered. According to the employee, staff observed a substantial increase in SNAP EBT theft beginning around 2021, including cases where newly issued benefits were immediately spent in other states before recipients attempted their first transaction, the caucus said in a letter, citing the Herald's recent reporting. In that same article, the whistleblower further reports that staff were instructed to tread lightly when verifying the identities and addresses of migrant applicants, even when applicants were declined to provide a verifiable address. Also described were repeated attempts by staff to raise concerns about fraud patterns that were dismissed or not acted upon. The caucus also cited the State Auditor's Bureau of Special Investigations, BSI, identification of over $34 million public benefit fraud in FY23, FY24, and FY25, as well as recent SNAP fraud busts uncovered by the U.S. Attorney's Office, including a $7 million scheme ran up by two Haitian men and a $1 million scheme ran up by a naturalized U.S. citizen from the Dominican Republic, who two illegal immigrants and one green card holder. The caucus is asking the committee to examine several aspects of the DTA's fraud prevention practices and internal management directives, including the agency's handling of SNAP benefits theft and coordination with federal partners, and the impact of the Emergency Assistance, Right to Shelter System, or SNAP, program integrity, and verification procedures for all applicants. Taken together, the BSI's multi-year findings, the whistleblower's detailed account of internal dysfunction, the federal government's discovery of large-scale fraud schemes, and the conflicting statements regarding referrals to federal authorities, these developments present a clear pattern of systemic vulnerabilities that warrant immediate legislative oversight, the caucus wrote. Responding to a Herald request for comment, Montigny said he had just received the letter and that it was too early to comment on potential hearing. About an hour ago, we received a request from the Senate Republican Caucus to examine the SNAP program. While we cannot immediately react to a letter we just received, this committee takes very seriously all allegations of fraud, waste, and abuse of public resources. Here's an article by Rick Sobey entitled "The Privilege of a Lifetime." Legendary chief meteorologist at Boston 25 is leaving the station. Another local media legend is leaving the building. Chief meteorologist Kevin Lemanowitz, will be stepping down from his role in Boston 25 News after 30 years with the station. His last day with Boston 25 News will be February 27th. "It has been the privilege of a lifetime to serve this community," Lemanowitz said in a statement. "Thank you for welcoming me into your homes each night." Having been the only chief at the station, I am proud of what we have built here, and know it will continue to be successful because I am leaving behind the best weather team in Boston, he added. I am thankful to have worked with the best in the business for the last 30 years. Now it's time for me to look ahead and see what the next chapter holds. Lemanowicz started at Boston 25 News when the station first launched in 1996. During his tenure, he has covered major storms like the tornadoes that hit in 2011, the snowstorms of 2015, and the Lemonster flooding. Kevin's commitment to excellence and to the people of New England has defined our weather coverage for decades. We thank him for all he has done here at Boston 25, said Vice President and General Manager Todd Brown. Beyond forecasting, Lemanowicz has particularly in many school visits, numerous charitable events, and community initiatives. It is rare to see someone dedicate 30 years to the one newsroom, said Kevin. And Kevin did so with professionalism, passion, and an unwavering commitment to our viewers, said News Director Scott Isaacs. We will miss Kevin's experience and wisdom when it comes to local weather, not to mention his forecast is the most accurate in the market. He set a high bar that we will always work hard to maintain. If you look at the police blotter by Colleen Cronin, unlicensed dentist drilled on fraud charge. A Milton man was found guilty early this month for posing as a licensed dentist and defrauding the state Medicaid program of hundreds of thousands of dollars, Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell's office announced Wednesday. After an 8-day trial, a jury found Fitzgabriel, 71, guilty of Medicaid false claims, larceny over $1,200, unlicensed practice of dentistry, and illegally prescribing controlled substances, the AG's office said. Fitz is scheduled to be sentenced at Suffolk Superior Court on February 26th. Gabriel billed MassHealth for root canals, fillings, and extractions that were never performed on patients, according to the AG. The office said the procedure billed to MassHealth were actually performed when Gabriel was not a licensed dentist. In total, Gabriel fraudulently billed the state for $245,000. While falsely presenting himself as a licensed dentist, Gabriel also wrote prescriptions for drugs including Percocet, hydrocodone, and the AG's office said, using the registration number and credentials of a dentist without that dentist's knowledge or authorization. The incident comes after a string of indictments for various forms of healthcare spending fraud, including a scheme to allegedly steal about $770,000 from MassHealth by charging for non-emergency medical services that never took place. Wow. And here is Pierre Lucas's column today. Healy goes for a Medal of Honor over NH and ICE move. Medal being M-E-D-D-L-E. New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte has a point. Those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, especially when it comes to criminal illegal immigration. Or, as Republican Ayotte put it to Massachusetts Democrat Governor Mara Healy, get your own house in order, Mara. The flap was over Healy's demand that Ayotte reject a proposed Immigration and Customs Enforcement regional Granite State site to house detained illegal immigrants, criminal and otherwise. The empty warehouse facility in Merrimack near the Massachusetts border would be converted into a 400-bed detention facility, one of several large-scale facilities the agency is planning to erect across the country. This is outrageous and absolutely the wrong move for New Hampshire, Healy said. Healy, born in Maryland, grew up in Hampton Falls, New Hampshire. Ayotte, in effect, told Healy to mind her own business, which is to run Massachusetts, not New Hampshire. Besides, many of the criminal illegal immigrants to be temporarily housed in the New Hampshire facility will likely be from Massachusetts, having been waived into the country by Joe Biden and into the state by Healey. And while Massachusetts is not an official sanctuary state, although Boston is, under Healey, Massachusetts acts like one. And the state's generous benefits, originally designed for Massachusetts residents, have made the state a haven for illegal immigrants who flocked to the state seeking these freebies, which, of course, cost Massachusetts taxpayers billions. So it's no wonder that Healey is opposed to cutting the state income tax from 5% to 4%, which will be on the 2026 ballot for voter consideration. Who needs money to pay for those benefits? Massachusetts has been a good deal for illegal immigrants. It's also why they have not descended on New Hampshire, which, to say the least, is not as generous to the illegal immigrants as Massachusetts. New Hampshire has no sanctuary cities. And unlike Massachusetts, New Hampshire supports local police officials cooperating with ICE. Illegal immigrants in Massachusetts are protected from ICE. If left-wing judges are not letting them evade ICE from the back door of courthouses, Healey is seeking to outright ban ICE from the courthouses. Excuse me. She says ICE made up of rogue agents who are breaking the law and causing devastation and harm, and she has joined the chorus of Democrats calling for its defunding. If Healey were so concerned about law enforcement officials breaking the law, she would also call for the defunding of the Massachusetts State Police. More state cops have been sent to prison under her watch than ICE agents. All the while, Healey has demanded that fellow Governor Ayotte do everything in her power to block a new ICE facility in New Hampshire. Of the demand, Ayotte told the Globe, New England is in this position because Governor Healey in Massachusetts created a billion-dollar illegal immigrant crisis in our region. There is no love lost between those two governors. Healey went to extraordinary efforts to defeat Ayotte in the last gubernatorial election. She raised money and actively campaigned in New Hampshire for Ayotte's progressive Democrat opponent, Joyce Craig, the former mayor of Manchester, who lost. Ayotte's campaign slogan was, "Don't mess up New Hampshire." And we turn to the sports and the Olympics and the USA hockey. Team USA survives to stop Sweden in overtime. This is by Steve Conroy. The same disaster that flirted with Canada early in the day was sniffing around Team USA on Wednesday. But like their arch rivals, the Americans were able to sidestep it and move on in the Olympic tournament in a heart-pounding fashion in Milan, Italy, after the U.S. allowed a late equalizer in regulation. Quinn Hughes kept the Americans' gold hopes alive with an overtime goal at 3 minutes and 27 seconds of the extra session to lift Team USA to a thrilling 2-1 victory over Sweden in the quarterfinals. The crafty, sublimely skilled Minnesota Wild defenseman took a drop pass from Matt Boldy and circled out high before cutting sharp into the high slot. In front of Gabriel Landeskog, he ripped a wrist shot past goalie Jacob Markstrom, who had 38 saves, and off the post and in. "You just want to pick and wait for your spot. I felt like I had one on the backhand earlier. I feel like I'm pretty good in open space, so I'm trying to create a shot for myself, and I was able to do that," Hughes told NBC. Surviving the gut punch of Mika Zibanejad's tying goal and 1:31 left in regulation was no small feat. "It's hard," said Hughes. "I don't want to say it's devastating because you're still in the game, but it's like, here we go, and you've got all that stuff going on in your head. But we've got guys who've won cups and gone deep, and some awards are superstars in the league. You just have to rely on the pedigree. You're playing Sweden, who can beat anyone on any given day. Yeah, it's a tough when they score with 90 seconds left." That ended a white-knuckle day of hockey. The U.S. now advances to the semifinal against tournament Cinderella Slovakia on Friday. Earlier in the day, Canada escaped what would have become a mammoth upset when they tied David Pasternak's Technia's team late in the third period and won it in overtime on Mitch Marner's backhander, sending them to the Friday's semifinal against Finland, which also advanced with an overtime win over Switzerland. While Slovakia and Finland will have something to say about it, the dream matchup of U.S.-Canada in the final is still on board, or on the board. "It's really special," said Hughes. "You realize how hard it is to get here, and you're sending one of the best countries home, if not the best. It's going to be tough for sure." And that is all the time we have today. Thank you for listening.